welcome to the Real Trail Runners of Jersey podcast. This is a show about the running scene here in Jersey, where we talk to people who run, what makes them tick and how they do it. The podcast is hosted by Lee Bennett and myself, Paul Burrows. Good evening and welcome to the Real Trail Runners of Jersey. Tonight, I am delighted to welcome Dan Doherty. He's an ultra runner and he's a fell runner. The races that he's done include Round the Rock, Thames Trot, the Anglo-Celtic Plate representing Ireland, the IAU 100K Championships, IAU 24-Hour Championships, the Tour de Gion, Welsh Fell Running Championships, and amongst many others. So the link really with Jersey, I know this is the Real Trail Runners of Jersey, Dan won the inaugural Round the Rock and came back the second year to win it again. So we've claimed him as our own. So how are you doing, Dan? Welcome.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm doing well, thanks. Good. You know, considering it's been a while since we've met.
Yes.
Good to catch up, especially during these times.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of stories at the moment. Obviously, everyone's got their own stories during these past sort of 12 to 14 months. I've been very lucky in that sort of, I live in an area where I can just jump out the house and run around the mountains without seeing someone. So,
because you live in Wales, don't you? In the Brecon Beacons, which is the prime place to run, isn't it? Really?
Exactly. Yeah. So I've been very lucky on that front and being a bit of a hermit. So I'm not missing out on much of the social life.
That's brilliant.
A man after my own heart, Dan. A man after my own heart.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice to see you again, Dan. We were just talking off air. The last time I seen Dan was at the start of Round the Rock race. That was the first and only time I seen him. I was competing.
I remember in 2011, which was the first race, and that was my first ultra. And I remember, I think I was at the far end of St. Juan's Bay when we'd heard that the winner had come in, you know, and you did like 6 hours 15, I think. And so by the time I got in, which was 9 hours 25, you were probably at a bath, in the bar afterwards, having a few beers sort of thing, you know. It was a hell of a time, and it stood that for quite a few years that time, I think, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right, before Steve Way
turned
up and smashed that. But obviously that's a runner on another level.
But then you got lost, didn't you, if I recall?
Yeah, I got lost in one place. I think because obviously you have that sort of common tape that's used in running. I think I saw another tape that was nothing to do with the race, and maybe, I don't know where it's from, and I followed that for a while. But it's one of those things.
Hell of a time that to get lost.
Yeah, it could have been a lot less then, and it's quite ironic considering that Steve Way's name's Way. Maybe you might have lost your way in that way, but he's definitely got longer legs than you, so maybe that's why.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a big unit to move
he's
around.
He's a big, long unit, isn't he?
Yeah, I think there was him and Paul Martelletti, wasn't it? They came, and then I think Paul Martelletti came back the year after and did 5:42.
Wow.
And ironically, I think the relay record is 5:45, so that just shows you. So a five-man relay does 5:45, and then he did 5:42, which is just, it's there to be beaten, Dan.
It is, certainly.
I remember hearing the time that you'd done it in, and I could not believe that was possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought I was all right. I mean, I came in the same as Paul. I was about 9:28. But I thought I would do a lot better than that. And I thought, oh, I'm all right with that. And then I could not believe that you'd ran that in 6:15. It was one of the first times in my life as a runner, I was gobsmacked.
I remember Digby doing the briefing and saying that they'd be at the first checkpoint by a certain time. That sort of, I looked at the schedule that I had, which was quite a basic one, just a piece of paper with a couple of times on, and I said to him, do you mind sort of having someone there a bit earlier? he sort of looked at me.
Who's this fella?
This guy's a bit confident. Hopefully, you know, I think there were a couple of people there just so I can have a sip of water and back.
Brilliant.
I've had that in a couple of races, actually. Probably when I sort of started training seriously, one of the first races I did was the coastal path along in Cornwall. Miler, and you start at night. And I don't think they realised that I would be going out as fast as I would, nor did I. And to be honest, in retrospect, I probably went out a bit too fast. I was sort of passing all the checkpoints before they'd get there. Obviously, not logging my time. So
yeah,
I think I did the first, it was about 25 to 30 miles with no water.
Oh, geez.
Just because there's no one there for the checkpoints. But I think, those were, even when you talk about sort of 2010 time, 2008, ultra running was still very much in its infancy.
Yeah, it was.
The race directors were learning, and it wasn't that competitive. There'd only be sort of a few people that would be, running at a level of 100 miles a week or whatever, and taking it really seriously. So,
when you were on the North Coast, did you run every hill on the North Coast? I've been dying to ask you this question for years.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Certainly. One of the things.
Did you walk any of it?
I don't think so. There may have been.
Wow.
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. It's been a while now. But
yeah.
One of the things I suppose this is why I've ended up sort of living in the Brecon Beacons, is even when I was a road runner and started my career off as a road runner, I trained on the South Downs. And when I used to run with people, my pace wouldn't slow when I hit a hill. It would just maintain the same pace. And I don't know whether that's my, biomechanics or whatever, but I don't struggle that much on hills or climbs.
Yeah.
So I've taken advantage of that, obviously. So I moved into mountain running. But
that is a great thing to have, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I was brought up at the basically bottom of Ben Nevis. We have our hill running championships there, and we have all sorts of things going on. It's exactly the same as fell running, really, in lots of ways. And we used to train as youngsters in the on the hills, and it was the hardest thing to do. And then someone said to me, what's even harder is running down them at pace. And I know that, maybe the North Coast here doesn't quite have that same, hill fell running kind of loose scree type thing going on. But, when you're running uphill at that particular pace and you don't need to slow down, that's, I'm not sure what to say about that, actually.
That's amazing.
Because I know how hard that hurts. I know cardiovascularly how hard that hurts. I'm not entirely sure you're human.
Yeah, well, there's different types, isn't there? So, like, you've got sort of running up hills on a road where it's more cardio and you're sort of running fast. And when you sort of move to somewhere like the Highlands, or you move to the Lakes or Snowdonia or Brecon Beacons, it's a different style of running when you run up a mountain. You can't run that full pelt up a mountain.
Yeah.
For 10 miles or 20 miles. And you find this, and it's something I call it, like, you bounce. It's a weird thing. When you're running up over time, when I first came here, my experience was 100K. So I was running on the road for 100K, trying to achieve a sub-7 hour. It was all sort of 6:30 pace.
Yeah.
It was all very clinical and, scientific, and it's all about numbers and time. You just can't do that on a mountain.
Yeah.
But your body's used to that. So when I first came to the Brecon Beacons, I would be giving it 100% effort up every angle possible. And it was only after sort of maybe 6 to 12 months actually training every day here that you find this weird bounce in your legs where you can just run and run and run. And it's not the kind of running that you would see on the road, but it's moving faster than a walk.
Yeah.
And it takes very little out on your legs. And you can still move quite hard, and it really works well for things like, these European races that you do. And I think that's the difference between, the people that you see at the front of the pack who have got this bounce where they can go up a hill for an hour without really
putting
too much exertion on their legs.
That must feel amazing.
It does.
To break through to that,
Yeah, it does. And it's a lot of effort. It's a weird feeling. Like, in the summer, I'll run up in a van every day, maybe 2-3 times a day sometimes. Yeah. And you get to the top and you haven't stopped and you haven't walked. And you think, well, that's great, And it's sort of, it's only when you go past someone who's walking and is really struggling up the hill, you think, well, actually, this is...
Yeah.
Because if you train yourself, I only train on myself. So you get no feel of how fit you are, or where you are sort of compared to other race runners at your level.
Yeah.
And it's only when you get into a race, or you may go out for a training session with someone,
yeah.
or, as you say, you've been running for, say, a 50 miles in a training session and you're still moving faster than someone that's out doing a sort of 5K, you think, actually, my fitness is
I'm doing all right. At the moment. Do you wear a watch or anything, or do you just...
I do, yeah. So I like to record stuff. So everything's sort of linked into Strava, and I have one of these Garmin Fenix watches, but only because it's not actually the distance I'm interested in or the speed, but I just like to know how much I've climbed. Again, you go from road running where it's all about the numbers, the splits and everything
totally,
else. And the mountains is about how much climb did I do. And as you said, it's not about actually the climb. It's the climb and the descent. So you always see in these events, it's, it's got 7,000, 8,000 meters of climbing, but actually you need to reverse it and say, oh, it's got 7,000, 8,000 meters of descent, which is what sort of takes it out.
Yeah, that's the bit that I used to watch when I was a kid, used to watch the Ben Nevis race. They would come down with no... they just would not be interested in their own safety. They would literally...
It's madness.
I mean, the top part of it was all scree, and they used to slide down that, and that's where the record was set when the scree was there. So then after that, they would just tumble down.
Wow.
The times on that fell race are phenomenal. And you know, it's a 14, which is around about 1,400 metres, but you start at sea level, so you get into the full 1,400 metres or whatever it is in that. But you're right, there's... you know, you don't get the kind of injuries you do on the road, that repetitive injuries, but you get more sort of physical injuries in the mountains. When I was competing in the World Mountain Running Championships in Annecy, in France, and I was coming down, you know, I was probably at my peak fitness then. I was coming down one of the mountains, probably in sub-6-minute miling on sort of semi-technical. It was through woodland down the side of a mountain. And I must have kicked a rock, and what happened next must have been amazing. If it was captured on TV, it would have been great. Because I kept going, you know, and sort of a bit of rock went through my sort of tendon underneath my knee in one and out the other side. So they're kind of injuries you get if you
if you're hammering it,
accidents on the mountains, rather than sort of tendonitis or things like that.
Jeez, yeah, that's hardcore.
Yeah, so I think that was me overplaying my skill there as well, sort of, you know.
But I suppose the quicker you go, it's like the higher the stakes, really, isn't it? Because, you know, somebody moving a bit slower probably wouldn't have. But that's, I suppose that's, you're trying to get down there as quickly as possible.
Yeah,
aren't you?
Absolutely.
So, it's, you know. So how long have you been running for now, Dan?
I've been a runner ever since I was at school. I think I grew up in a kind of, I grew up in a quite a poor sort of, you know, childhood, and we used to walk to school. Even at the age of four, I'd be walking to school, and it would be sort of miles. I'm not comparing myself to you know, an African child walking to water, but it was, I had little legs, and I would walk to school every day, and it was, it seemed to me like for miles, and I think it was. And we never had a car, and everything would be walk or bike. And I think I just built up a fitness, a sort of base fitness as a child. And then sort of I got involved in cross country as a kid. Then I went to university and met beer and clubbing and takeaways. That was it for about sort of all the way through my 20s, essentially. And then I got sort of, being a lawyer is kind of a sort of aggressive hours you have to do.
You're a what?
A lawyer.
A lawyer?
Yeah.
I never knew you were a lawyer.
So I'm actually head of legal for a fintech company in London. I was just saying to Paul, actually, in addition to that, I'm also doing a PhD in climate science. So I'm very busy at the moment.
You must be good with your time management.
Time management, yeah, it's mad. But especially when you're a junior lawyer, you work very long hours.
I can imagine,
it would be sort of quite stressful. So I get up early, drive into work, sit at a desk all day, come home, have literally a bottle of wine, a pizza, and then same next day. And I'd be lying in bed and just my body would be in pain just through lack of movement.
I can imagine.
This is a slippery slope.
Yeah.
So I did this in 2008, first one I did since I was a kid. And it was called the Nike Race Around the World or something like that. And you start at Wembley Stadium and you do a 10K. I came in about 43 minutes, so not too bad. I thought, well, actually, you know, I like this running business, so I got back into it again.
Yeah.
And I think sort of my generation of ultra runners, I'm not sure it's the same now, but we were all from the same club in that we were obsessive. Like if we weren't running, we'd be obsessive into something else. Like it would be drink or drugs or something that's not good for you. And we converted that into running, and that's what I did. So I went from 10K first race, and bearing in mind, totally unfit. Like I would do maybe 20 miles a week training, if that.
Yeah.
And then my second race was 50K trail race in the South Downs.
Wow.
And then I basically couldn't walk for about 2 months after that. But that was always my mindset. It's never sort of, well, I'll sort of go into this
gym. Yeah, ease into it.
It was just, you know, wow. I need to, you know, what's the furthest distance I can run? And, you know, it got to a stage when I started to do sort of the more serious running, it converted into that. So I would be doing, especially with the 100K road racing, I would not be happy if I was running under 100 miles a week and I'd be aiming for 150 miles a week in training. I would be on a Sunday morning, like struggling to get my leg over the door because I was that tired, knowing that I've got a 10 miler to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I look back at it, I go, there's no benefit in that at all. And it probably did more damage than more harm than good. But it was just that obsessive nature that I've eaten a cake. I need to go out and run 10 miles or because I'm going to put that weight on or, you know, it's absurd.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I suppose the only interaction I have with any lawyers is watching Suits, and it's not a bad day. It's not a bad program. And it kind of showcases that kind of definitive nature of absolutes almost in lots of ways. And what you're describing is that kind of absolutes, isn't it? Of, well, I need to do that. I've got to do that. I have to do that in order for me to do that. And, you know, in order for me to succeed, maybe I need to go and do that. I won't be happy unless I've done that. Mm. And we've met a few people who kind of have similar, you know, head states like that. But a lot of people who don't, a lot of people that can't have that absolutes, they have a doubt. They have a doubt and they follow it. And then they can't, you know, get to that, what they need to get to. So, What does it feel like for you then? Or is that a description there that rings a bell with you?
Yeah, it is. It's you're chasing something that's not there. So you're trying to, I wouldn't say it's perfection because there's no such thing in running as perfection, but it's this, you get into this mindset of there's so many different things, as runners, that you have to worry about is like your mileage, your training, your competitors, the race, the pack, your nutrition, your normal eating during the day. You know, when you're running to compete and to win in races, it's not like we were sort of Olympic athletes that we had a team around us telling us what to do. We were just winging it. One minute we got people telling you you need to go on the paleo diet. The next minute, you know, you got people telling you to run barefoot. And you try to make it up as you go along.
God, this is like a catalogue of every mistake I've made. You know, I think we've all been there, haven't we? You know, it's so true.
I remember actually, it was a race where it was by that guy called Rory who did the MDS stuff.
Oh, Rory Coleman.
Coleman, that's it.
Yeah.
And it was a race where you did sort of on the Saturday you did a 50K out and then along a canal and then you did a 50K back. There was this young kid running. I might say it wasn't even like the five fingers. It was barefoot.
Oh, no.
And he finished it, the first 50K, and shredded, absolutely shredded. You know, I just, it's one of those things about sort of, when you look at the science of a lot of this stuff, and obviously I have a science background, is what people like to do is they like to take chunks out of these papers that are good sound bites and then run with it. And then actually, if you read, the way science works is it never works like that. You read the paper and there are so many caveats. And we've limited the research to this, or we've applied the barefoot to mice and it worked well with them. You know, these kind of things. Paleo stuff, like, you know, the best kind of diet is a diet that was replicated by humans 100,000 years ago or whatever it may be. But we still don't truly understand what they were eating. And they were probably eating a range of food, including meat, including sort of sweet things that could be found in nature. But also we don't live like they live.
Exactly.
you know, and they didn't have the pressures and the all the other bits and pieces. They didn't have advertising between Coronation Street and EastEnders or whatever. Well, you don't get advertising between EastEnders, but yeah, they didn't have all this junk. You don't have to walk past KFC with that lovely smell and things. So it's an interesting one.
There's a big thing, I think, to almost get back to basics. And I think we're running, you know, there's that whole thing. Like you say there, being born to run, you know, born to run the book, bare feet running, paleo. It's almost like, you know, going back to that basics and those, the olden times is the best, isn't it? They sort of talk about, you know, the advent of the running shoe and how that's bad and how you shouldn't have support and all these sorts of things. But
yeah, it's a difficult one. I can see the common sense of it in that, you know, we haven't evolved as humans that much, you know, from when we were running to hunt animals and whatnot, other than shoes are put on us from, you know, 3 months old onwards. So that's obviously going to change your gait over years. But I agree. I think common sense is probably the best advice that you can give someone, which is use your common sense. What works for this person over here may not necessarily work for you. You've got different shaped feet and legs and hips as the person over here. So you problems. And also sort of, you know, your nutrition, your body may react differently to a certain type of nutrition compared to this person over here. So the best thing you could do is try stuff, go out. If it works, great, note that down. If it doesn't, push your weight, even if everyone's telling you that it should work, you know?
Dan, what's your shoes when you run the hill? What are they?
A range. So I suppose traditionally I would be sponsored by someone, so I would wear those shoes. So for a while I was wearing a lot of Scott shoes, wearing the Kinvara, which were a good shoe.
I've had a pair of them. They're good.
They're good shoes. Actually, for the road, I would wear the Saucony shoes, which I like. So like the Kinvara. For the at the moment, see the Brecon Beacons is quite a difficult place to train because you have sort of the bogs. And then you have a bit of road, and then you'll have rock, and then you'll have rock with grass on overlaying the top. And then, you know, you'll have proper bog where you're down to your knees. So it's difficult to find the right shoe. And at the moment, I kind of use the Innovates. So I would use the Rocklights.
Good shoes,
mainly the Rocklights. I would use sort of the... forget what they're called now, X Talons. I like those as well.
They're bomb proof, the Innovates, I think, aren't they? The lugs are just so grippy that they just really cope well with rocks, slippery rocks.
Yeah, exactly. But I've never found a shoe that's like, I think the best shoe to have is a shoe that you don't think about. So you don't think they're good or you don't think they're bad. You put them on and you run and you don't even think about them. Like, nothing draws your attention to them because they fit so perfectly. They're not rubbing. Your toes are not clenched together. They don't, you know, they're perfect. And I find it difficult to find a shoe that does that. But I think that's more to do with the years of ultra running that I've been doing. And I've got trolls feet, which have, and they have changed shape over time.
Are they flat and pancake like? Are they? Or?
Not far off it. And trying to find shoes that are wide enough to sort of.
You've been sponsored by quite a few organisations, haven't you? And I'm trying to think if you are sponsored by a particular organisation. This may be a bit of a I don't know how I can word this question, but if you're having to run with their kit on or their shoes on, can you find a shoe in amongst that brand?
What if you don't like any of their shoes? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, it's a valid question, and actually, it depends on who you're sponsored by. If you're sponsored by someone like Scott, they have enough range of shoes for you to at least find one that you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're maybe with a lesser known brand that has perhaps only one or two, you're stuck. I know some athletes that will bang on about them on the socials and then have them on the starting line and then literally change them to run in, make sure they don't get capped on the way.
Awesome.
And then put them back on
and then get them on the finish line.
Yeah.
It's like cycling teams, isn't it? There's some cycling teams who are like sponsored by, like say, by Trek, and they've actually repainted Bianchi bikes, say, for example, with Trek colours, so that during the races they think they're riding a Trek, but they're actually riding a Bianchi. Same thing, isn't it? Really, it's like that whole, you know.
And I take it that, you know, when you are sponsored, is it that that's not just shoes, is it? You know, that is it all other stuff as well that goes with it?
Yeah, usually you get the whole kit that's available for them. So they give you maybe a couple of sets. And then, if you want more, depending on what the deal is, they'll either give you sort of a substantial discount. And that's when you learn how much profit they make. If you're on the shoes. Some of them are okay if you just say, look, I've got a race coming up and I need an extra pair of shoes here. Or that. The problem is that, you know, a lot of them will get annoyed with me, A, because of where I train. So that usually the trainers get very wet and muddy and then they dry out and then they get wet and muddy and then they just crack and rip. Mm. And I'd get probably 150, so maybe 200 miles out of a pair of trainers, which is less than a month. You'd be going through a lot of trainers, or you'd be running, you know, in a pair of trainers with your feet hanging out, which is, I suppose, barefoot.
That's what you're talking about, though, Dan, isn't it? You know, the mileage that you're putting in is, you can't measure it against road running or trail running almost, because you're running in the fells. You know, the mileage cannot be compared. It can only be compared to fell running.
Yeah, so I did a 50-mile training session on Sunday, and if you went onto Strava and looked at my splits, it's absurd. So, you know, I thought I'll go out slow. It's 50 miles. I don't have aid stations, so let's not go out sort of too quick. But straight out, up a hill, so I'm doing maybe 8-9 mile, and then onto some sort of road. Not road section, but sort of a trail. So I'm maybe bringing it down to 7-minute miling. Yeah. And then sort of get further into the central Brecon Beacons. And there's a mile that took 22 minutes, you know. So
yeah,
it's totally was your game. I got to on the top and it was flat, but the temperature was so cold. There was a snowstorm that came in with gale force winds. And that took just as long. And that was on the flat.
Was that Penavan or?
It was, yeah. So it's on there. There's a ridge that leads up to Penavan, and it's exposed massively. Mm. So you got the sort of it's basically a valley, and it's just a ridge on top of the valley, and you just get the wind shoot right across.
So that's your training ground. That's where the SAS train, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
they call it the fan dance, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, I see a lot of soldiers around training and sort of. Me running about like
in a t-shirt and shorts, and they're like in their full kit. Warning!
I've had a couple of those times where it's been because I kind of know the area so well, and you know, to get to the bottom of from the bottom to the top of Benavan, it's 2 miles. If you go the sort of more difficult route, so you're never too far away. So at most, sometimes I'll take a sort of wind jacket. That I can fit in a pocket and literally just run up to the top and that. And sometimes you get to the top and it is like one of these sort of films where it's Armageddon and you'll see like all these squaddies like thoroughly fitted up. And there's me like, morning. And just kind of like, what the hell's going on here?
You must be loving your life right at that point though. Yeah. It's
likely me. Like you see, sort of, we've got a couple of running clubs around there, sort of Minif D, which is worth for Black Mountains, and they'll be the same, you know, and they'll all be running about. They know the mountains well, and they're used to training in temperatures and high winds. And
of course,
you know, we all sort of take safety equipment with us, but you're used to running in very cold temperatures and shorts.
What a great training ground, though. I mean, to be able to, you know, that must set you up for all sorts of races.
I've been to a lot of places, and I think. So I've traveled quite a bit. I've been to sort of mainly the Alps. I'd love to go to the Himalayas, but running for Ireland, they've taken me all across sort of Europe and running in beautiful places in Portugal and Italy and Spain. And, you know, I've raced Zugspitz, which is Germany's largest mountain around there. But there's something about the mountains here. And two places that I I just think are the best, and that's the Highlands. Just the history there, and I remember we were just doing a little bit of a run around the Highlands, and it was around Glen Nevis, and we came down this craggy area, and you look behind, and you've got the clouds coming in over the mountains, and the one of the oldest sets of mountains in the world. You can, they're just rugged, and it's everything you want. You know, it's beautiful, and there's a similar sort of feel when you run around Snowdonia. Again, those big, beautiful,
it's amazing
mountains
up there.
Yeah. The weather changes, comes in. You've got about 20 different types of day in a couple of hours, and it's beautiful. And I'm sure those who live in sort of the lakes and not whatnot would say the same. They're beautiful, beautiful mountains. They're obviously not as big and not as sort of, you know, spectacular on a grand scale, but, you know, they've got character. I think.
They do the job. They do the job. So in the intro, I mentioned quite a few races that you've done. Did I miss anything out there of note? I know you've done quite a few.
The main things sort of went a lot of my career, my 30s, was very much focused on the World and European Championship stuff that I did for Ireland. So, I mean, that included a lot of different races. So at the beginning of my career, it would be very much 100K on the road around Holland. So you'd do 100K, and it would be basically the World Championships. And it would also usually include the European Championships. Sometimes I think they split them.
Right.
And you'd be racing the top 5, 10, 100K runners in each country. And, you know, you'd get all your top countries in there, UK, USA, Italy, France.
I bet that was an amazing experience.
And it was an amazing feeling, because the day before you'd usually be presented in the town or wherever it is, and it was usually some beautiful little town in Holland or somewhere along those lines, and you'd march out with your kit on, your trackies, and your flags and everything else, and you'd really get into it. Everyone would be walking around with their Lucozade. and then you'd go out, and it was when I look back, it's so different to trail and mountain running, because it would be so. We would literally have on the table like little 250ml bottles, and sellotape to those bottles would have gels, and we'd have a team with us that would be at all the checkpoints. And you'd write down on the paper, right, checkpoint one, I need this, and I need this, and I want this. And, you know, and there would be, these guys would voluntarily come over with us, and, you know, we would be there, you know, for the day, or they'd be out for the day. And it would be, right, I've done 6:37 or 6:38 on that last mile. I've got 7 seconds to make up for the next one, because if I don't hit a 6:30 average, I won't be close to the 7 hour mark for the 100K. And that was all your focus, and so you forgot about the pain of running 100 kilometers. It was all about watching that time slip away from you as you got, and inevitably when you got to the 50 mile mark running at that pace, you know, unless you were like these kind of guys like Steve Way who were like coming in at 6:20 or 6:40 or whatever those times were. You get in, I'm sure they suffered as well, but sort of you get into the 50 mile mark and you're just holding on, and cramp is kicking in. You know, you've been through, I don't know, 20, 30 gels or whatever it may be. You know, it was horrendous.
So stomach's doing somersaults and.
Yeah. And we'd always you'd see, there'd always be the Italians, and they'd always find, you know, there'd always be this. Did you skip a corner there, or because you went on our paces as well? So like, you'd be 50 miles in, and one of you run past this guy, and he's got a pacer with him. You're like, you can't, yeah, because it's IAU, so it's like, you get sort of AAA or AA sort of athletic allocation if you complete certain times. So they're quite important races. Yeah. They're the equivalent of, you know, IAAF or whatever it is for Olympics. But you'd see some of these people, like, you know, with their little paces or skin a sneaky sort of gel from here or there, and you'd be like, gee.
So why was it held in Holland then? Is it because it was very flat?
Yeah, so 100K road races are usually, they're minimal elevation. You know, you're doing about 2 meters over the 100K elevation.
So you're like a finely balanced thing, like you say. You know, you've got to hit certain pace averages. You know, I can imagine that's ripe for injuries, isn't it? You know, because it's that repetitive. You know, you're running at what, 90% capacity?
Yeah. It's weird, actually. It's one of those things where you get so you obviously, like, you think, well, how do you train for 100K? Well, you don't go out and do 100Ks every week. I would actually do sometimes as training a 50K on a Saturday and then a 50K on the Sunday. The idea is to get to a level where running at 6:30 is comfortable and you're not thinking about it. You know, it's just a stat, you know, it's a, you could comfortably bring that under six if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But you're making an effort to stay around the 6:30 mark because that's a relaxed pace. Yeah. So your shoulders are relaxed, your hands are relaxed, you know, your neck is relaxed and you're running at 6:30 pace.
So 6:30 would probably feel like about 75% then, wouldn't it, I suppose?
It would be quite low. Obviously, as you run, you know, as you get into the 5-6 hours, it then becomes a lot more effort to maintain that 6:30 pace because you've got so much muscle damage and...
Yeah,
that's unbelievable. I mean, I don't even think I've run a mile at 6:30, let alone all that. I mean, and what one of the things I'm looking at here is that, Dan, you know, that you're talking about the IAU World Champs here, but I'm just looking at your CV here, and a lot of these you've won. You've either won, got a record, you're the winner, you're not out of the top 10 at all in any, you know, even the Tour de Gironde. Sixth in that, you know, Celtic Plate, sixth in that, you know, Ultras, first course record. I mean, is there anything that sticks out in your mind as being your favourite race of all of those that you've put in your CV there?
Yeah, well, I've got two that are very different but mean a lot to me. So I think the Anglo-Celtic Plate, so maybe I'll put the book, but I actually won it 1 year, which was a couple of, about 2014. I think it was the last time I actually did a 100K race of that kind, because I thought, well, once I've won that it's not going to get any better. So the Anglo-Celtic Plate is quite an old race, and it's England versus Ireland versus Scotland versus Wales.
Oh, nice.
And it's usually done up in Perth in Scotland. It's around a park, and I think it's about 2 kilometres, a walk around the park, 2 kilometres, and you go around it 50 times.
What?
But that it's kind of weird when you do that kind of thing. That's good. That's what you want, because you know where you are. You know, it's not about the beauty. It's not about the scenery. It's about the technicals, and it's about having access to your guys. You've got all your nutrition and you know, massage you if you've got problems. And it's about you basically near enough see where the checkpoint is constantly. So it's good. You can measure out your pace. You pee while running. It's literally,
you haven't got to carry anything, I guess, because you're,
you don't
you're
have to never... carry anything. And
you pee while running. There we are. That's cool.
Yeah. It's not recommended. I'm sure it's not legal in a park.
but I mean, not even that. I'm talking about the sheer logistics of that.
It's not easy. And you can tell how many people do it because you start seeing zigzags.
what about number twos?
I've probably had some of the most scenic number twos of all time in my career in training. But yeah, so the Anglo-Celtic Plate was it meant a lot for me, sort of running for Ireland. So I ran a lot for Ireland in my 30s, and running in the sort of the World and European Championship, I'd always finish sort of 16th or 15th in the world and maybe close to top 10 in Europe, but never a medal place. Because, you know, for a medal, you either get a medal for finishing top three, or you get a medal for your top three or four runners in your country finishing. So this was actually the only race I won with the Irish shirt. And, you know, so it meant a lot. Mm. And then the other one is Tour de Gironde. That's a different level. It's, as you may know, 200 miles. And I can't remember off the top of my head, some absurd, something like 21,000 meters of climbing or something like that.
Yeah. We talked to somebody else who's done that, actually, Leanne Riv, who I think won the Round the Rock the year that you did, and she's gone on to do the TDG a few times.
It takes you to different levels, and it's a different ball game because, like, if you're competing, you don't know where you are because there may be someone like it's changed now. If you want to finish in the top few, you don't sleep. You run straight through. You may have like a 30-minute rest here or there, but you don't really sleep. You may even have a 15-minute power nap or whatever. Yeah. But you get so tired, you hallucinate. I was looking at my feet. I couldn't work out if it was touching the floor or not. And then I was at the top of a mountain looking down, and I couldn't work out. I was like, can I just run straight? Clearly, I couldn't.
Straight down the ridge or something like that.
Switchbacks and stuff like that.
Brilliant.
And then, you know, a cyclist came up to me in Italy. They love sport and they love this kind of sport. And it's an amazing atmosphere. You know, you see sort of women in their 80s at 2 o'clock in the morning sitting on a deck chair drinking wine as you come out of this forest from the bottom of a mountain cheering you on. You know, it's amazing. And there's so many memories from the Tour de Jeunesse, one of which is sort of, I was doing very well one year, and I remember coming, the sun had just come up, and I was coming over this col, and there was lots of scree on this peak, and there was, do you call it a herd of ibex? I don't know, I'm going to call it a herd of ibex.
Sounds good to me.
On the scree, walking along, it was absolutely beautiful, and I came over the col, and there was the sun rising with the Matterhorn.
Oh, wow.
In the distance with the clouds underneath. And I thought, well,
amazing.
When people say, why do you do this kind of stuff? Why do you put yourself?
Yeah.
It's for moments like that. So yeah, the Tour de Jeunesse was one. And I suppose the Tour de Jeunesse, it kind of mentally killed me. Maybe, I think it was in about 2016, which was the last time I did it properly. And I was in second place with 50 miles to go. And the guy ahead of me, was not looking that great, and I was really confident. You know, I just passed some people that you see in magazines, ultra running magazines. I thought, Jesus, you know, I practiced, I trained so hard, I was so fit and confident, and I was moving hard, I was climbing hard. You know, only 50 miles to go, and some went in my IT band, and I couldn't lift my leg anymore, and I was at this checkpoint for an hour, and still no one had passed me. So, you know, I was doing very well. And I was like to these guys, look, can you inject me with something, you know, ibuprofen or something? And I'd already taken ibuprofen. It was making no difference at all. I was like, I need to get this 50 through because I think I can take the win here.
Yeah.
And I thought, look, I'm going to try and climb this mountain. And I got to about 100 meters up and I had to lie on the floor. And then I can't do this. And then I just waddled back to the checkpoint, and that was it. And I have not recovered mentally from that loss.
I can imagine.
You know, it was so tough because it was...
I can imagine.
Yeah, it was, you know, to train as we do, you know, you speak to the likes of, I don't know, Damien Hall, who's sort of doing very well at the moment, or some of the others. You train hard, you make a lot of sacrifices, whether that's socially that's, you know, whatever it may be, the comforts of life, and for these kind of moments. And it goes to that thing, like, you've got to learn yourself. And Tour de Jeunesse was my baby because I'd done it before and I finished sixth. And then I come back the next year and they were like, who is this Irishman that is like smashing these mountains? Because even you look at the Brecon Beacons, or even the Highlands, don't train you for 21,000 meters.
I can imagine,
climbing. And to get so close to the end, and 50 miles is still far. I don't say that I had it in the bag. You know, there's a lot can happen in 50 miles. That's a race in itself. But it was a big sort of dent in my ego and in everything else, and it was difficult to recover from that.
Did you sort of think then when you had to retire from that, did you think, you know, this is I'm at my best here, am I going to be able to repeat this again?
There is an element of that, and you know, I recovered the next year and then won the Welsh Trail Running and the South Welsh Trail Running Championships.
Yeah,
and then after that, it's been sort of downhill, like from a training perspective, I kind of lost the. Yeah. I think I sort of burnt out. Maybe I had a bit of injury in the hips that thankfully took about 18 months. But it wasn't the hips itself, it was like the hamstrings, because I was doing all these big miles and not stretching, and I was getting a lot of, or not stretching properly and getting a lot of, what's it called, sort of...
calcifications.
Sort of in the hamstrings, and my left leg wasn't stretching as much as my right leg, so it was forcing the hip to... all those kind of things. So it was, I think it was a perfect storm where big race loss, sort of loss of momentum, and then I suppose that the injury, and then, you know, so hopefully this year is going to be more positive.
Because I had noticed that you'd sort of dropped off the sort of racing thing, because I, you know, obviously we're friends on Facebook, and I'd sort of keep up to date, you know, by seeing what you're up to. And I noticed over the last few years, you hadn't really done as much in the way of racing. And I wondered whether it seemed like, you know, you're obviously living in the Brecon Beacons, and it seems like you've kind of retreated into a more of a, you know, you're a mountain runner, you run for the joy of running there, it seems like.
Yeah, and I think that's it. I mean, even when I was sort of running quite frequently, it wasn't as frequent as most runners of my level, who would be running maybe racing every couple of weekends, or depending what they were, or certainly doing three or four big ones a year. I'd still be doing only about maybe two or what, because I just preferred to go out and run, and I didn't like the tapering, because then that would be not as much running. And even I think about some of the stuff that I did, especially in the 100K stuff, that I could have been so much better if I'd been sensible and had common sense, because I would still be doing... like if I had a 100K race on a Saturday, by the Saturday, I would have still probably logged about 70 miles training in that week. And it's totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
And I clearly was not on fresh legs.
Yeah.
That was like what we were talking about earlier, that mindset of just trying to get that little bit of advantage or convincing yourself. Because you take, and this was a serious problem I had, was I'd taper, and then my body would start to shut down after like this long period of hard training.
Yeah.
And it would be constantly hungry. Like, it was like, okay, you stop running for a bit or stop running as much. Yeah. Right, get some food in you. And then I'd get some food in and I'd be feeling my waist thinking,
yeah,
if I put on weight here, I'll go out and do a 20, 30 miler. And then I'd definitely want to eat after that. And then I'd eat again and put another. And it's absurd. Yeah. Because that's not how it works. Like,
no, of course.
But that's how the head works, isn't it? That's what the head's telling you. And, you know, to go from... Are you saying that you're retired now, Dan? Is that...
No. So I've got... No. I think it was just a long term.
Because you don't look... people that are listening can't see what I see, but he still looks about, I don't know, 17 in the screen in front of me. me and Paul have got big beards on. He's just sitting there with a fresh face on, looking like he's about to... He's just come back from a run.
It's because I can't grow a beard like you guys.
how old are you, Dan?
41.
41, right. Okay, yeah. So I'm 46. You're 40. How old are you, Lee?
I'm 46 as well. 46.
So we're all similar age. But have you noticed that, you know, as you've kind of gone into late 30s, you know, you were saying there with the issues with not stretching and stuff, that it does take longer to recover. Injuries are more sort of frequent, and you know, the body can't do what it did in the sort of mid 30s or early 30s.
Yeah, I think you definitely have to be clever about how you train as you get older. I still think you can maintain a good level of fitness. I mean, you look at some of the ultra runners today that are doing very well, they're in their mid 40s or early 40s. So I don't think that's an excuse at the moment.
No.
I think what the problem is that if you are like I was training when I was 30, trying to put in 150 miles a week, while doing everything a 40-year-old should be doing.
Well, you work as well. So it's not like you're a professional full-time athlete, is it? You work as a lawyer and then you're doing 150 miles a week and you've got a family. So, I mean...
Yeah, so I don't do 150 miles anymore. So I try and keep it down to, you know, I'm getting back into... So actually, last year, I was doing about 20. You know, my body was that sort of messed up. I was only doing about 20 or 30 miles a week. I'm back to sort of 70 or 80.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I get into spring and close to the races that I'm going to do this year, which will be the first races in about 3 or 4 years, I'll be looking to sort of hit around about the 100 mark, which I think... I think 100 mark, a good 4 week cycle of 100 miles and close to maybe 10,000 meters of climbing will be perfect for me.
Yeah.
And I'll go and do that. I'll spend long weekends up in the Highlands or up in Snowdonia just hill repping.
So it sounds like 2016-17 then, you almost like you maybe fell out of love with competitive running. Is that kind of a thing?
And yeah, gone, I think so.
You've had some, there's some kind of journey that's gone on there, isn't there? I think.
Yeah. I think so. I think it came from me not racing well, and that was my own fault, but me training so hard. And I was like, why am I making these sacrifices?
Yes.
So hard and stupid things. Like, I'd be DNFing every race I was doing because my mind wasn't in it. Like, I'd start feeling struggling a bit and thought, well, hang on, I train hard. Why am I struggling? And walk off the course. I traveled to the Tour de Jeans about 2 or 3 years ago. I went over the first peak, climbed up the second peak, turned around, walk home. I was already, well, I didn't walk home because that would be quite a long walk, but walk back to the checkpoint.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, admittedly, it was about maybe 20 miles into the 200 mile race, and I'm still sort of front of the pack.
Yeah.
But not that far, but sort of maybe in the first sort of 20 or whatever.
Yeah.
But I was like, I'm not in the game here, and just turned around and walked back. And people were like, I'd see all people that I know from the UK go, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So that's the question I'm asking. I'm going to ask you now. What in the hell were you doing? What was going on? what was going on with you?
I don't know. Again, I think it was that. I think what I needed was a break. So I think I needed to be at home and not race and not run and not run. Because when you're running well and you're strong and fit and like which I'm feeling at the moment, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to go out. And like I did the other day, I ran 50 miles and at the end, I felt good. I felt
it's
like
great,
I had
one isn't it? Miles,
and I thought, this is a good sign. I enjoyed that. I had a couple of runners high along the road. I listened to my audio book. I experienced the mountains and I feel good. And I feel like I could do another 20 tomorrow or another.
That's 30. Amazing, isn't it?
And that is a great feeling. Not only sort of physically, but it's like, I've just done that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost mastery of oneself, isn't it? In a lot of ways, you know, it's.
Yeah. But I think I needed to leave all that for a year. Thankfully it kind of worked in the same way as that. I sort of fixed the injuries. And that's mainly as well because I was traveling a lot to London. So I was sitting down a lot. Sticky hips and then going out and training for 20 miles. It just, office jobs and running don't always work well together.
They don't, do they?
Stretching and stuff.
Yeah.
And then I've got that sort of, looking around thinking, oh, there's all these people showing pictures of winning races. I remember that. Or just doing races and running races. And I've got that sort of, I want to get back into the game. And see how it goes. And I've picked a beauty for it.
So you've taken the healthy way, really, haven't you? You've sort of said you're going to wait until that fire is reignited rather than trying to sort of force it, sounds like.
Yeah, there's a few people that I think suffer from the same thing. And I won't say who because I don't think it's fair and I could be completely wrong. But there were a lot of runners when I was running around in the early teens that... We all know each other and we'd all be as obsessive in running and in the mountains or on the road. And they've all disappeared. And I think they've kind of either sort of overdone it from the training level, because again, they were running 80 to 100 to 150 miles. They've overdone it and burnt out and haven't recovered. Or they've, again, sort of fallen out of love with it and...
Yeah.
Still waiting for the mojo to come back.
It sounds like there's a group of us here in Jersey who ran in a very similar, you know, probably not to the same level as you, but we were all going out and doing, you know, I went to the MDS, there's people who went to Lakeland 100, UTMB, all that sort of stuff, and everybody, there's a group of us and we've all gone through that and then come out the other side, fallen out of love with running, and now we're all kind of regrouping again. You know, we all go out and we do social runs and it's like we're kind of rediscovering the reason why we run again. So it seems like you know, I can totally empathize with the journey that you've sort of it's comforting in a way to know that it happens, you know, because I think sometimes you can feel like it's just you, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes you need something like a race or something along those lines to get back into it, because I was kind of, when I was getting back into the running again, I was training, but I was like, well, what is this doing? You know, there's no incentive to run faster tomorrow than I did the day before. So I'd just be going out and just doing base miles, which, you know, is fair enough, but it's not enjoyable if you haven't got a target.
So what's this target then?
What's the beauty you've aimed for?
I've got two things. So I did have the South Wales Traverse record, which is basically my home. It's running the entire length of the Brecon Beacons.
Nice.
And then Damien Hall came down and beat it by about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So definitely in June, I'm going to be back on that start line to give that another crack.
Nice.
And then the second race, which is going to be interesting. It's going to be very similar to the Tour de Jeans, but it's broken up. So it's the Dragon's Back.
Nice.
Which is kind of claims itself to be the toughest mountain race in the world or something.
What a great race. What a great race.
Yeah. And they're extending it this year to 300 miles. So it will be from Conwy Castle in the north of Wales down to Cardiff Castle, obviously.
Brilliant.
In South Wales. So I'm looking forward to that.
Go past your back door, Emily.
It does. I've already checked the map. It's like it runs right past the house on the Taff Trail here. So
brilliant.
Really looking forward to that because it's exactly the terrain that I train on. And it's a beast.
It's a race I would love to do. I think it's just, I agree. It's probably one of the toughest races, isn't it, in the UK?
Yeah, and I've never done anything like this before where you're forced to stop deal with your DOMS and everything else.
Yeah.
Usually I like a race to sort of, just
straight through.
There's
a lot of admin then, I think, isn't there? A lot of kit management and all that sort of stuff, which you have to sort of take into perspective.
Yeah, so I've got a lot to learn there because I'm not that great. So, for example, I'll go out in my training runs. Again, I wouldn't advise this, but it's just how I've trained over time. I'll go out and do a 30 miler with sort of no water and maybe no food. Just because I would like to run light. I might have a couple of sips in a stream or whatever to get me going. But I've been caught out a few times with that one. But I've realized, well, I'm not following the basics, which is train as you would race. So carry the weight of the food and the water and everything else. But when you've been running for so long, sometimes you forget these things and you get into your own habits with training.
Particularly when you're sort of perhaps starting again as well, because you've obviously been through I think that's something that we've discussed in a few podcasts, is when you still think mentally you're at a certain level, but potentially physically you might not be, but physically mentally you think you are, and it's easy to then come a cropper, isn't it, at some point.
Done that so many times, like the amount of times in my head I've got out of the car to do maybe a 25 mile run and done six. Because I've convinced myself that's the case, that I could just go out and knock 25 miles out today. And then when you think about it, you think, well, hang on, it's 25 miles, it's a long way.
It's a big deal, isn't it?
It's funny because I was just thinking that about 5 minutes ago, because we were talking about you starting off at 20 miles a week and getting to 100, and we were just, it's amazing how easy you fall into this kind of level of running. I'm nodding along going, oh, yeah, I get that, yeah. I very rarely run 20 miles in a week.
Well, when you said about a 6:30 minute mile earlier, I was thinking, I haven't seen one of them for at least 7 or 8 years.
Did Bannister not get near that years and years ago?
I don't think I've seen a 20 mile run but back when I was like going to the MDSA, I'd do 20 miles back to back on a Saturday and a Sunday and talk quite casually about it, and now it's like, I go out 7-8 miles on a Saturday and a Sunday, and I feel very happy about that. But it is amazing, isn't it, how your horizon sort of shift.
It's weird. I feel odd, especially when I speak to sort of non-runners about it. And I feel sort of like, sort of blown your own trumpet, but I'm not even thinking of that because
no.
70 miles or 70 miles, I do it so often, it doesn't really...
It is what it is, isn't it? It's not even like humble bragging, you know, they talk about humble bragging, but it's just... That's in your reality, isn't it?
It's not that amazing. Like as you say, it's like most people could do that if they're willing to make those sacrifices, go out every day, do a 5K in the morning, do a 10K in the afternoon or evening, do some, you know, core training, and did that continuously. Your body would adapt to it. You know, that's what makes us so successful as a species, is that we can do those kind of things.
But I have a different history than you have, you know? And I don't have memories of nearly finishing the Tour de Gion or winning, you know, becoming first in the Anglo Celtic Cups and stuff. So you've got that kind of history. It must be quite a, you know, to exist at that sort of elite level for a period of time, and now to be considering going back to two, you know, although they're similar races, they're not. One is about breaking a record and one is about competing terrain that is, you know, that is significant, you know, it's scrambling, all that type of stuff that comes with it, and then having to fall into the admin that goes with it. So
there's something I've seen a lot in the sport, and I've definitely suffered from this, is ego DNFs.
Yes.
So you see it a lot, and when you start winning, that's it. Or when you start you don't settle for anything less. You get some runners that actually don't care and they're good and it doesn't matter whether they come first or seventh or tenth last. But I went through it as well and I saw so many and I'm like, you're bullshitting here. But basically, so many people suffer from stomach issues during races and stuff like that. But no, it's not. You realise that you're in eighth place and you're expecting second or third and you're three quarters away in the race and now you've decided that actually eighth is not a great shout for your social media, so you've DNF'd. And I think that is, I don't think that's true, but I think, you know, I've suffered from it and I've seen very similar
situations
with others thinking, well, you're just doing what I've done many a time before, which is an interesting one. Ego, you know, there's a lot in the sport about it being sort of carefree, and especially in mountain and trail running, it's all about being with the trees, man. But actually, reality is you put a race in the way, and it's about egos, and it's about
it. And particularly when you are, you know, hitting the podium, you know, the stakes are probably a little bit higher, aren't they? Because, you know, some people are sponsored, some people aspire to maybe do it professionally, don't they? So, you know, there is more of the pressure then to continue to be achieving, I suppose, if you're, you know. I'd like to sort of talk about, you know, when you're sort of saying there about doing races and you went to the Tour de Gion and you said your head wasn't in the game, you know, that's a really interesting. Do you think that's looking back at what you'd achieved and sort of you were saying that, you know, I'm training, I'm not getting the payback. So do you think you're almost cutting yourself off because those previous achievements are almost a stick to beat yourself with, sort of thing?
It's difficult to really know what the head not being in the game really means, because I think it's lots of micro factors that build up over time, whether that's not feeling good, not being happy with training, the memory of success, the being sponsored and the pressures, as you say, of that.
Yeah.
You know, convincing yourself that actually you're going to go to this race and you're going to smash it when you're clearly not ready for the race.
Yeah.
You know, and also just bearing in mind, I think when I DNF'd on the second one, it was just the altitude, you know, and I hadn't even thought about that. I hadn't thought, well, actually, I'm climbing a, you know, 2,000 plus meter mountain.
Yeah.
It's 30 degrees. I live in Wales. I'm bound to struggle. And because, you know, I hadn't run for a while and I've got all these negativities in my mind saying, you know, you've DNF'd a lot recently and, you know, you're not on form and, you know when you're training whether you're running well. I think all of those made it very easy for me just to turn.
To call it quits.
I spent days traveling there and countless, you know, money and stuff, getting the kit ready and dreaming about it and everything else.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Spend about 2 hours on it.
Yeah.
I might as well just walked it and enjoyed the.
I went to the MDS 2 years after I'd done it in 2015, and my head wasn't in the game. And so I'd spent $5,000 to enter the race, and I pulled out after 3 days, and then I had to rebook all my flights to get home because I didn't want to hang around. And it was so I can totally empathize with that, where you've kind of, you know, you've been obsessed with something, and it's horrible, isn't it?
And that's people who run who are trying to figure it out. We imagine people who can't run or don't run and have nothing to do with this world go, you spent what?
I know.
On what?
I know. Plus all the kit. It's crazy. So I think then we are nearly on the hour, so what we'll do, we'll call this episode one. So I think to wrap it up, let's just talk about, if I came to you now, Dan, and said, look, I'm just starting to maybe, you know, to enter an ultra, what advice would you give to somebody just starting out as an ultra runner?
A lot of the advice that you commonly hear is common for a reason, because it's important and it works. So I didn't listen to that advice. And I went from 10K to an ultra race and couldn't walk for a couple of months because I'd absolutely destroyed my legs. So I think it's important when you go into an ultra race that you think about what kind of ultra race you're doing. So think about distance. Think about, more importantly, weather. If you're from the UK, maybe an ultra race in south of Spain is not the best first ultra for you to do. You know, think about maybe doing one in the UK. So focus on, you know, the biggest challenge for you is going to be distance and running that distance. So just make that your challenge in your first race. Don't make terrain and weather and everything else a problem as well. You can add that as you feel more comfortable. So, try, you know, if you're not used to mountains and you're not used to technical trail, then perhaps a road ultra would be your best option first. And then, you know, if you're comfortable with that, then start adding additional challenges to that, whether that's terrain, whether that's weather, whether that's multi-stage. I think that's probably the first thing that they need to think about.
Brilliant. Okay, so I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll call it quits there, and we'll reconvene next week. So I look forward to all your stories from all the races, and we've got some cracking questions to ask you as well. So,
I look forward to it.
Dan, you're a gentleman. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Honestly, it's been cracking. I've really enjoyed this. Yeah, we'll speak to you next week. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye. That was a really enjoyable episode. Not very often you get the chance to talk to somebody who's kind of at that elite level of running and really sort of dive into, you know, what makes them tick. You know, he's obviously won a few races, or he's been at the sort of sharp end of the races, but he's still encountered problems whilst running. And I think that's the thing that we all as runners share. Stay tuned, because we are doing episode 2 of next week. We shall be asking more questions, and we should hopefully be delving a bit more into what makes him tick. So hopefully you'll stop by for that one. As always, we welcome your feedback. We're always looking to hear from the guys who listen to this podcast. Please email me on paul@trailmonkeyjersey.com, or you can reach us through Trail Monkey on the Facebook page. Just search for Trail Monkey Jersey, and the same, Trail Monkey Jersey on Instagram. Please, you know, reach out to us, let us know what you think of the podcast, any suggestions or any feedback at all.